Hello everyone, my name is Tony.
My name is Dylan.
And my name is Brianna.
We are all students here at the University of Michigan, and we are here today to talk about global pollution and its effects on the oceans. While we will be talking about the environmental effects of pollution, we will be taking it one step further to talk about how pollution influences the lives of the peoples and cultures who rely on the ocean to survive. If you don't get anything else from this podcast, just remember that if the ocean ain't happy, ain't nobody happy, and we hope you'll understand this by the end of the podcast. Before we get started, let's discuss some background information on pollution. In general, there are three main types of pollutants that contribute to ocean pollution. The first group are non-biodegradable plastics. In the United States alone, 220 million tons of plastics are produced each year. Out of these millions of tons of plastics produced, the United Nations Environmental Program estimated that in 2006, for every square mile of ocean, 46,000 pieces of plastic are floating around. Even worse, this number continues to grow each year with no foreseeable signs of slowing down. The second group of pollutants are sewage and other wastes. Pipes carry these wastes to the oceans and to other bodies of water that eventually flow into the ocean. Once these sewage wastes settle in the ocean, they create dead zones that deprive the area of oxygen. Without oxygen, animal species and other ecosystems cannot survive, leading to the isolation of large areas of the ocean that were previously inhabited. Finally, the third and largest group of pollutants are pesticides, which account for 80% of the ocean's pollution. Farmers spray their crops with these chemicals, which eventually run off into the groundwater. When the groundwater eventually reaches the ocean, fish come into contact with the chemicals, which accumulate and are stored in their skin and fat. Humans eventually eat these fish to survive, thereby also unknowingly ingesting harmful chemicals. A major example of such pollution is the 2010 BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. This was a terrible environmental disaster, which lasted 87 days before the leak was finally closed. Overall, it spilled 130 million gallons of oil into the Gulf, much of which is still negatively impacting the humans and animals that rely on the Gulf of Mexico for survival 6 years later.
Like the oil from the BP spill that spread out and negatively affect the ecosystems of the oceans, chemicals spread to other cultures and affect lives such as that of an Inuit tribe in Canada, which we'll discuss. We want to be able to shut the faucet off because trying to clean up plastics is just a tiny drop in the huge ocean. So how can we do this? Non-degradable plastics such as styrofoam that disintegrates into tiny particles and toxins such as DDT, PCBs, and nitrogen are causing serious problems, as you've heard. DDT, PCBs, and DEHP, among other things, are known carcinogens and can cause birth defects, hormonal problems, and immune system problems. An environmentalist, Stephen Palumbi, talked about how the Inuit women in the Canadian Arctic are being negatively affected. Their main food source is seal and whale meat, but toxins in the ocean are accumulating in these animals' fat. These toxins are then transferred to the women, and they are exposed to these carcinogens. Another effect that isn't as well known is that their breast milk becomes toxic to their children, so they can't effectively feed them. These women are forced to adapt and find new food sources, which can be very difficult.
Here with us today to give her perspective is a professor and researcher at the University of Michigan here in Ann Arbor, Dr. Melissa Duhame. She's part of the Ecology and Evolutionary Biology program, and she's here to answer a few questions.
So could you tell us a little bit first about just what you do here on campus?
When I moved here to Michigan, my previous experience had been looking at plastics in some of the large ocean gyres. In particular, I'd been on a cruise in the Southern Pacific Gyre, as well as the Northern Pacific Gyre, and the mission of that cruise was to collect plastic that was floating in the surface of these waters, and then to look under the microscope at what was there. And too bad I don't have my laptop open, because I can show you some impressive images about what the plastic looks like that you're collecting from the surface, and I can pull those up later if you're interested.
Cool.
But the intriguing thing is not necessarily what those look like, but the differences between what those samples look like and those that we now are pulling out of the Great Lakes. Because upon moving here, I then shifted my focus to our backyard, and I started asking the same questions and doing the same studies in the Great Lakes. And this poster here actually represents the first project that was funded to do that here in the lakes. And in your first question that you asked, you hit upon a lot of diverse issues related to this topic. So we know plastic's out there. Is it harmful?
More than just ugly.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
We know it's aesthetically displeasing, but what is it doing? There are many ways that it can influence a natural, pristine environment. And we're only now getting beyond the counting, so essentially tracking the concentration of plastic. And what that tells us is a very important number we refer to as encounter rate. So the degree to which it's harmful matters most when you consider the rate that organisms might be encountering it and how that rate compares to the rate that organisms encounter other things in their natural environment, either other food sources or other objects that might interfere with their behavior or alter their behavior. So I'd say that most of this field of research is actually still, it's just slowly transitioning from tracking the abundance of plastic and the distribution of plastic to starting to get at those other questions that you asked as far as, well, what is the impact? Mm-hmm. So counting seems pretty simplistic, but once you put those counts in a framework to understand their ecological implications, they're actually very important data points. And then counting gets trickier as you move beyond counting water bottles that you can see with your eyes to counting how many tiny plastics are there in a single drop of water. You can't just use your eyes anymore. You have to use more sophisticated techniques. Mm-hmm. And that's where we've devoted a lot of the last year or two research, is going beyond counting those big pieces to the small pieces, which we call microplastics, and even nanoplastics, so beyond the microscale. So these big pieces, we've been hearing and seeing pictures kind of describing their impacts for decades, right? It started in the 80s and 90s with the problem of can rings, right? Those like six-pack rings. Can, yeah. So I would call it, that's like big plastic. That's not microplastic. That's things you can see with your eye. Yeah. And so the issues that had been documented there and the kind of the awareness that had been built upon that problem was more related to strangulation and suffocation and entanglement and kind of problems of big debris, problems for big animals.
Yeah.
But now that a lot more attention has been devoted to looking at this problem of plastics, we recognize that the problem's not with the big stuff. The bigger problem's with the smaller stuff. And it's also a kind of logical when you think of the kind of math and physics of it, that all these big pieces are going to break down into smaller pieces. And those smaller pieces will be more numerically abundant than the bigger pieces. When you break things down into smaller pieces, it also means that there's more surface area, like a lot more surface area. And now we start thinking about what are the implications of the plastic physically being out there. Well, one thing we've begun to appreciate is that just like other particles in the water, whether it's sediment, sand, piece of a shell, a leaf, a stick, they act as surfaces to attract toxins. So we hear in the Great Lakes a lot about these kind of legacy pollutants or toxins from industrial activity around the lakes. And we know that the concentration of these toxins is highest in the sediment, and that's because they don't hang out in the water column, the free water, for very long. They want to be stuck to things due to the chemical properties of the toxins and the things they're getting stuck to. They want to get out of the water. They're hydrophobic. And as a result, most of those toxins accumulate in the sediment. But now that we have all of these plastic particles out there, those plastics don't necessarily all sink, but they serve as a really great surface for these hydrophobic toxins to stick to. And so now we have a kind of conceptual framework where these toxins are sticking to the plastics, but the plastics are sinking. So does that mean that they're staying up higher in the water column and possibly the exposure to larger organisms that might encounter them is increasing? Because they're not sinking out like the sediments. So that's one kind of hypothetical problem that depends on a problem I mentioned earlier, which is how do you count those tiny pieces of plastic if you can't count them by eye? So I'd argue that we actually, even though we can predict that this might be a big problem, the higher encounter rate, because these toxins we know are there are binding to the plastics. The plastics aren't sinking, they're floating. We can predict that the encounter rate is going to be higher. For instance, a fish that might eat this small plastic and then be exposed to this toxin that it might not otherwise be exposed to. But I'd argue that we don't have really good data on how many small pieces of plastic are out there, like of the nano and micro scale, and what their load of toxins is. And closing that loop, I'd argue we don't have solid enough information about the transfer of toxins from plastic to organisms that might ingest them and how frequently organisms ingest them. And here it gets back to a previous comment I made about why do we need to know the numbers of plastics that are out there? Okay, it's encountering, but it's also how does that rate of encounter compare to the rate of encounter between an organism and other things? So if there's one piece of plastic loaded with toxins for every 10 million pieces of possible food for a fish or an organism, then you'd probably argue maybe the problem of the plastic is not that important in the grand scheme of things. It's not going to have a major impact on the health of the organism or the fitness of that organism in the ecosystem. So there are some things that are probably true, like there are a lot of plastics out there and they're loaded with toxins. But there are some pieces of information I think that are definitely missing that would help kind of tell us the relevance, like relate the relevance of how important that problem is,
yeah,
if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So I think it's easy to kind of go with the headlines that are pretty sensationalizing, like, wow, there's a lot of plastic out there. There's all these harmful toxins, carcinogens that are bathing these plastics, but there are a few really key pieces of data that we're not solid on yet that prevents us from saying, and this is the impact on the ecosystem that we could predict or that is happening.
Gotcha. So it sounds like the world doesn't quite have a definite plan on how to fix all these, other than they had the cleanups, but we still don't know how to manage all the toxins and whatnot. We could briefly talk about just oil spills. I know that's not quite plastic, but you think the plastics are a way bigger problem than the oil, or the oil is a bigger problem, or it's fine?
I'd actually say I think the plastics are a bigger problem. I mean, that's hard to they're very different stresses on the environment, right?
Yeah.
Like one is a kind of what we call a pulse. Like you just have this, boom, there's an oil spill.
Yeah.
And we're actually learning the ways that kind of the natural ways that are that problem can be kind of mediated by the environment and by the organisms in the environment, in particular microorganisms that can gobble up the oil. Of course, there are impacts and lasting impacts, and there's mortality due to oil spills and local impacts on fishing industries, and they're not nice. They're dirty, messy problems.
Yeah.
But I'd say the pervasiveness of plastic in the environment makes it a more difficult problem to address. And the persistence of plastic in the environment makes it, rather than a pulse stress, it's what we call a press stress. Like it's there
worldwide
all the time. And it's not going to go away. There'll be plastic much longer than there are humans on this planet. And that's a fact.
Yeah.
Well, unless we like completely shut off the faucet tomorrow, which
cool.
is probably not going to happen.
So then what if you've encountered this in your studies or not, do you think it starts to apply to displacing different cultures, be it island cultures where it's really clearly affecting the fish they hunt, or even...
Well, I think like a lot of the other ocean stresses that different populations will certainly be differentially affected. So if you're relying primarily on ocean protein sources, then for sure your culture or your group will be more affected by another group that doesn't rely as much on fisheries, for instance. And we know that fish are being affected by plastics. We find plastics in the guts of fish pretty much everywhere that I think it's been looked for. So in the Great Lakes, we also find plastic in fish guts. We haven't necessarily closed the loop to explicitly show what the impact of this plastic is on the fish. So that's why I can't necessarily give a definite answer there. But like any other group of people who are intimately connected to the water for their livelihood and their sustenance, they will disproportionately be affected by plastic in the environment. And most of the plastic, they'll probably be kind of influencing them, will be from other sources because so much is washed on shore, and it only takes a year or two, for instance, for plastic to move from Asia to the west coast of the US, which means plastic is transported pretty quickly to remote parts of the world.
Could you tell us a little bit about aquatic viruses or if you have anything to input on that?
Yeah, so I don't know if this was where you're going with it, but one thing I can add about, actually it goes back to your first question. So yeah, we're out there in the lakes counting plastic and trying to figure out how to count these tiny, tiny plastics as well as quantify the toxins that are on them. Another major thing that we do in our lab is we look at the bacteria that live on the plastic and ask what potential effects they might have on both environmental and public health. So we know most bacteria, over 99% of them, are harmless. They're just there everywhere, covering our bodies inside and out, in the lakes, on plastic. But it's that small percent that are pathogens that we're looking for on plastics. And we have some reason to hypothesize that they will be there in disproportionately high abundance, for instance, more prevalent on plastics than in water. One basic reason for that is that pathogens like living attached to surfaces. For instance, things that cause infections, they like being on wounds or in lungs, or they like high density environments where there are a lot of other microbes around, living in sticky, gooey substrates, which these plastics offer a great opportunity for. And if you just made an inventory, a species inventory of the microbes that are living on plastic versus background free-living microbes in the lake water, you definitely see a higher proportion of pathogens or potential pathogens living on plastic. That's now been seen in both the ocean and in the Great Lakes. And so what we're now looking into is what the implications of that are. So on the one hand, it again comes back to that first problem I posed, which is, just like the toxins we know are on the plastic, we know there are these potential pathogens on the plastic, but it only matters if there's enough plastic out there to be of concern and enough plastic out there with respect to other food sources for it to be of concern, which I'd argue, again, we're not quite sure yet, but we also know there are pathogens on these plastics. And another thing we're asking is more of a microbial ecology question. So we suspect that plastics carrying these pathogens are entering the lakes from urban centers. So that makes sense, right? That's where humans and livestock are coming in contact with these plastics. And so you can imagine a model where pathogens are getting on, and then the plastics are getting washed out into the lake. And we know that the species that are on the plastics change whether you look at plastics that were collected right outside of a city or in the middle of the lake. And so the things we're asking are, how does that shift happen? And as plastics, for instance, drift from downtown Cleveland out to the middle of Lake Erie, are the species that are there, are they shifting to non-pathogen types? So are those pathogen ones just kind of dying and not persisting, and the microbial communities are now being dominated by things that are not pathogens? Could be one scenario. Or are pathogens persisting, and do they persist for years and years once the plastics are out in the lakes? Those are the types of questions that we ask related to microbial ecology and the potential impacts on public health. Another place that we might suspect them to pick up pathogens is in wastewater treatment plants. So a lot of plastic ends up in wastewater treatment plants, either through runoff or directly down the sinks and drains from people who use personal care products with plastics. So now you have these plastics, which we know pathogens like to jump on, moving through wastewater treatment plants where there's all kinds of other stuff that we all know what's there. Mm-hmm. And so it could be that they're picking up pathogens in these plants, and then because of the insufficient screening of wastewater treatment plants to remove some of these plastics, could be them releasing the pathogens out to the lakes and the environments.
As you just heard, plastic pollution is a problem that is going to be here longer than humans will be. Now that we know it only takes a short time for plastics to reach the other side of the world, we know that people who live near the ocean are at severe risk for losing their ecosystems and possibly food sources and way of life. After listening to Dr. Duhaime, we want to reiterate that many people know about the big problems like large plastics invading the oceans and shores. But we want to raise awareness about the persistence of these plastics, particularly when they break down into micro nanoparticles. More specifically, how they enter a human ecosystem and disrupt the culture and daily life. This is an important issue because while these smaller plastics are not visible to the eye, their effects are detrimental and visible to everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you've learned a few new things about pollution and its effects on the ocean. This problem isn't going to go away by itself, so go out and get involved.